I'm speaking mostly from a book that I have published called The Lost Promise of Civil Rights, and that's about civil rights before Brown versus Board of Education. But the book is really motivated by a lot of what we've been talking about by looking around and asking, how is it possible 100 years after the NAACP was created, more than 50 years after Brown v. Board of Education, that there's still so much racial inequality in this country, that there's still such a correlation between race and economic inequality. And so as we look back 100 years, I think we might ask ourselves, how does this state of affairs persist? And I think there are lots of different kinds of answers that people can give. There are political answers, economic answers, cultural answers. I'm a legal scholar, so if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So my answer is going to be a legal answer. It's one that that levels some criticisms at various choices that the NAACP made as it was pursuing the litigation that led to Brown. And I was thinking about what Benjamin Jealous said about Brown being both a success and a failure, and that's very much how I think of Brown in the book and how I'm going to talk about Brown today. And I offer these critical comments as a reflection on the past so that we can think differently about the future and the problems that that we still see today. And my hope is that by unearthing things about the history that we didn't necessarily know before, we open up our imaginations about how to go forward and what kinds of strategies we can use. And because I'm a legal scholar, particularly within the law. So before I go to the past, I want to think about what Jim Crow means and what Jim Crow meant before Brown versus the Board of Education. So after Brown, we've largely defined Jim Crow as a legal regime, a regime of formal racial subordination imposed by governments at various levels of segregation and discrimination. So Ben used the terms de jure and de facto. Jim Crow obviously existed in both, but we often refer to it in recent decades as mostly a de jure system. We think about the denial of the right to vote by governments. We think about schools segregated by law. But in the pre-Brown era, I think that there was a broader conception of what Jim Crow meant, that Jim Crow was also thought to be about material equality and not only formal legal separation and discrimination. So Jim Crow was about worse jobs, the hot, heavy, hard jobs, the three H's. It was about having less money. It was about attending worse schools. It was about being subject to lynchings and violence and terror and involuntary servitude. And if you think about Jim Crow as having been a replacement for slavery, not an immediate replacement, not an inevitable replacement, but ultimately, over decades, a replacement for slavery. Slavery was a system of race, and it was a system of labor. And Jim Crow was also a system of race and labor. It was both material and formal. It was both public and private. So slavery, when you think about when slavery ended, white people in the South, I think, asked themselves two questions. First, they asked, how would they prevent newly freed slaves, newly freed African Americans, from contaminating the white race and from debasing white politics? That's the racial question that they asked themselves. And the second question that they asked themselves was, how would they find a replacement for the cheap labor black slaves had been providing for centuries and on which the Southern economy was largely based? And when you think about Jim Crow as a replacement for that dual system, it becomes clear that Jim Crow is an answer to both questions. It was both a system of racial subordination and a system of economic exploitation. It was a system that was created through law and also through private associations, private decisions by both individuals and organizations. So it was public and private, and it was material and formal. In the period before Brown versus Board of Education, I think this was clear to a lot more people than it has been clear to since Brown. And many African Americans and lawyers in the NAACP and elsewhere saw both sides of Jim Crow and tried to attack both sides of Jim Crow. And this, I think, was particularly apparent to African-American workers, both African-American agricultural workers and African-American industrial workers. So agricultural workers who complained to lawyers in the pre-Brown decades, they complained not simply about racial segregation and racial discrimination. They complained about peonage and involuntary servitude. They complained that landlords stole their crops, stole their money, stole their land. They told of terrible conditions in which they lived, living in chicken coops, barely having enough to eat. They told about not being paid proper wages. They told about violence and imprisonment and lynchings. Industrial workers, their complaints were different, but they were equally diverse, and they were equally about material conditions as about formal segregation. They complained about being excluded from many industries, and even within industries that they were able to find jobs in, being excluded from many of the best jobs in those industries. They complained about being segregated within workplaces. They complained about the hot, hard, and heavy work. They complained about low and unequal pay, violence on the job perpetrated by white workers, union segregation and discrimination, and they complained very often about their sheer inability to get a job at all. Now, after the years that Francille was talking about, the NAACP took the cases of lots of African-American industrial workers, and I know I don't have a lot of time, so I won't talk about all the reasons that that led them to take these cases, but these cases are largely overlooked by history. The stories that we tell within the NAACP's legal campaigns are stories that lead on the road to Brown, so stories about teacher salary equalization cases and school equalization and university integration cases. And so these cases get overlooked, but I think they tell us a lot about how people in the NAACP and how black workers conceived of what the law could do and how it could redress the problems of Jim Crow, and reveals to us ways of thinking about civil rights and civil rights law that I think have largely been lost to us today. And one of the things that's really interesting is that these cases, I think, reveal a less doctrinaire stance on the part of the NAACP than one might get from the treatment of W.E.B. Du Bois and the marginalizing of folks like Abram Harris, that in fact during this period, during say the 1940s, the NAACP was quite open to lots of different ways of legally challenging the problems that black workers faced. And you see a tremendous experimentation among lawyers, some lawyers who haven't had lots of publicity, people like Marion Wynne Perry and Prentice Thomas, who were the lawyers who focused on labor in the 1940s, the NAACP, but also Thurgood Marshall and others who flew around the country taking cases on behalf of African-American workers, especially those in war industries. And these cases show the NAACP challenging both the public and the private parts of Jim Crow, and challenging both the formal racial discrimination of Jim Crow and also the material inequalities of Jim Crow. So the targets of NAACP litigation on behalf of black workers in the 1940s were both state actors, like the federal government, the United States Employment Service, things like that, and also private actors, especially unions that segregated and discriminated against African Americans. The NAACP also brought cases that they didn't only argue that workers were entitled to formal equality or formal inclusion or formal non-discrimination. They also made arguments about rights to a job, rights to work, a right to advance economically. So they were talking not only about a non-discrimination norm, they were talking about economic substantive justice. They were talking about the ability simply to get a job. And although the NAACP was always opposed to segregation, it understood that economic advancement within the confines of segregation was also important. It wasn't until 1951, in fact, that the principle of segregation became an official formal tenet of the organization, passed by the organization. And so within the confines of segregation, much like it did in the education cases, the NAACP lawyers pushed to help African-American workers do as well as they could so long as segregation continued to exist. So you'd see complaints about a shipyard that had a white part of the shipyard and a black part of the shipyard. And you could do two things with that complaint, right? One thing you could do is say, we need to integrate the white and the black shipyards. And another thing you could do is say, there aren't enough black managers in the black shipyard part. And they did both. They were not particularly doctrinaire about only taking one kind of case. And by the end of World War II, these industrial worker cases looked actually quite promising toward providing opportunities for the NAACP to make head-on attacks against segregation and against Plessy versus Ferguson. They had gone relatively far toward vindicating workers' rights against governments, against labor unions. They were starting to, they'd been trying to make attacks also against private employers, and that seemed at least partially doable. And there were indications that gaining a right to work against protected by the government might happen. There's another whole part of my book that I just want to mention briefly, but I'm not going to focus on because we're here to talk about the NAACP, which is that at the same time the NAACP was taking these cases and making incredibly creative legal arguments on behalf of African-American industrial workers, there was a new, very small unit of civil rights lawyers in the Department of Justice who were taking cases on behalf of African-American agricultural and domestic workers. And they were basing their arguments largely on the 13th Amendment, and they were using the 13th Amendment to try to expand a lot of the New Deal protections for labor and for economic security that had excluded agricultural industrial workers as a compromise with white Southerners who didn't want the large majority of African Americans in the South who were agricultural and industrial workers to be covered by these laws. They used the 13th Amendment in conjunction with the New Deal to try to protect these workers who lived in the most desperate poverty. So the NAACP and the Department of Justice were both pursuing different ways of trying to find affirmative government protections for African American workers. So what happens, right? Why have we never heard of these cases? What happens to these cases? Why is my book called The Lost Promise of Civil Rights and not The Found Promise of Civil Rights? In the late 1940s and by 1950, and especially by 1951, the NAACP is faced with making some hard choices. Times have changed. The Cold War is somewhat limiting acceptable political discourse. It's changing the position of the NAACP politically. Conservative politics are on the rise. The NAACP is in a new kind of relationship with labor unions that affects the kinds of cases it can bring, but also gives it political alliances with labor unions. And the result of all of these political, institutional, economic factors, as well as real philosophical and principled concerns about Plessy versus Ferguson and about the direction that their litigation campaign should go in, the NAACP lawyers, especially Thurgood Marshall, decide that they're really going to pursue a challenge to Plessy in the education context. And workers really get marginalized within the legal department of the NAACP at this time. And I say that, but it's not to say that the NAACP as a whole, and this is where I think Francia was headed, it's not to say the NAACP as a whole forsakes workers. Certainly that's not true. Clarence Mitchell, Herbert Hill, and Robert Carter on the legal side of the NAACP when the Inc. Fund and the NAACP really cut ties to a much larger extent in 1956. The NAACP continues to advocate for workers in lots of ways. But the legal department of the NAACP, which eventually becomes the Inc. Fund and which is the engineer of Brown versus Board of Education, really says labor is a political issue that should go along with the political department, and it's not a legal issue. It's not something that we're going to litigate right now. And at the same time, choosing education, Thurgood Marshall says we're really going after Plessy versus Ferguson. We're really going after state-sanctioned formal segregation. we are no longer going to countenance arguments about advancement within segregation. And our goal is really to overrule Plessy and not to take on the issue of private discrimination at this moment and private economic inequality. And there are lots of good reasons for that that I'm happy to talk about. But this choice has real consequences, I think, in part because the NAACP is so successful in Brown. And one of the things that they have to do, I think, in order to succeed in Brown is prove that Plessy was wrong. Plessy had said that if Homer Plessy felt discriminated against by his inability to sit in the white railroad car, it was only because he felt it. It wasn't because the state had done anything to him. And the NAACP wants to show that that's not true, that segregation in and of itself, absent discrimination, absent inequality, is a harm. And that's a huge thing, and they succeeded. And it was big and a success and really, really important. But in the process, in order to show that segregation by itself is a harm, you gotta separate out all the material inequalities. You gotta say, let's set them to one side and just ask about segregation. And in doing that, which they successfully did, they convinced the court that the essence of Jim Crow was state-mandated segregation, that that was the real problem that we were talking about. And when you read Brown, it talks about Jim Crow in those terms, and it emphasizes how important the state-mandated formal segregation is. And so Jim Crow comes to be represented as a problem of formal law, as a problem of stigma and symbolic harm. And I do not mean to say that it is not all of those things. It most certainly is all of those things. But it was also a system of incredible economic exploitation and inequality. And had you asked one of the farm workers who was represented by the Justice Department, is this the Jim Crow you have in mind? I don't think he would have said that it was, right? We come through Brown and through the way Brown captures our imaginations, we come to marginalize, I think, the poverty, the economic exploitation, and the material inequalities that Jim Crow had also embraced and perpetuated. And this leads, I think, when I say we, I mean primarily people within the legal profession, but I also mean we as in the imagination that we all have as constitutional interpreters are in our own right in thinking about what the Constitution can do within civil rights. And there are two myths in particular, I think, that get perpetrated out of Brown that have been incredibly hard to overcome and pose a really significant obstacle to the racial inequality that we still have today. And these are that the real harm of Brown, the real harm of Jim Crow is formal discrimination and the idea that the government shouldn't classify people on the basis of race. And the second is that the rights that we have under the Constitution are negative rights that stop governments from harming us rather than positive rights that require governments to help us. And you can see both of these ideas in the parents involved school desegregation case from a couple of terms back, where the majority on the Supreme Court thinks that the harm of that case is that governments have made decisions about where children go to school on the basis of race, and they're not allowed to do that, even if they're trying to promote integration, even if they're trying to get kids a better education, even if they're trying to combat the kind of racial isolation that Benjamin Jealous was talking about earlier. So we can see the reverberation of this image of Jim Crow and the limitations, the blinders that it puts on what law can do to end it. So if you think that Jim Crow, like I do, if you think that Jim Crow is both a system of formal segregation and discrimination and also a system of private and public exploitation, then you see that Brown only undermines half of Jim Crow. It needed to undermine that half of Jim Crow, but it only undermines half of it. It only goes after the state-mandated part. It only goes after The formal segregation part. And this story is not finished after Brown. Obviously, there's the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Obviously, there are lots of other cases. Obviously, we don't end up just parroting Brown all the way through. But I do think that all of the efforts that have been made within the law to deal with de facto economic inequality, de facto material inequalities, de facto school segregation, butt up against the limits on our imagination of what Jim Crow was and what the Constitution can do that were set in Brown. Now, by telling the story, I don't mean to say that the world would be better today if the NAACP had made the opposite choice in 1950. I think both of the choices on the table were necessary to uproot Jim Crow. And nor do I say that the current state of affairs can be blamed on this choice that the NAACP made. These lawyers had limited resources. They had lots of constraints on the way they spent their resources. And they made the best choices that they could, and they made choices that were incredibly successful and worthy of incredible awe and respect and admiration. But they did make choices, and in part because of their success, their choices have been really, really successful. My point, rather, is to reopen possibilities that have seemed closed off by looking back at the past. And these myths that we tell ourselves about Brown and about Jim Crow, they limit our imaginations about the possibilities for constitutional redress of material inequalities today. They lead us, I think, sometimes to believe that currently, that the current racially inflected economic equalities that we see are happenstance. We fixed Jim Crow, and now we've got a different problem, unrelated to Jim Crow, that needs to be fixed. But if you see Jim Crow in its entirety, then I think you can see that the current situation exists in part because we only ever succeeded in undermining half of Jim Crow. And so the current racial inequalities that we have are actually the remnants of the system of Jim Crow, and not something unrelated to that system. So my hope is that by telling this alternative story and putting on the table these cases on behalf of industrial workers and where they could have gone and what they could have meant, that we open up the future of constitutional understandings of civil rights by revealing these contingencies in their past.